Hello there, and today is Thursday, April 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as President Trump plans to reopen the country, experts warn if done too quickly, the U.S. could see a deadly second wave.
Going all the way back to the 1918 flu epidemic that killed many people in the United States, it wasn't the first wave that was bad, it was the second. People came out and that virus swept back with a vengeance.
California says it will help migrants in the state legally who can't qualify for financial assistance. And a couple of classic rock bands plan to hold free online weekend concerts. It's all on today's International Edition. There is cautious optimism that the U.S. COVID-19 outlook could be improving. In remarks at the White House coronavirus update on Wednesday, response coordinator Dr. Deborah Birx said it is still a dangerous virus.
This is a highly contagious virus. Social gatherings, coming together, is there always a chance that an asymptomatic person can spread the virus unknowingly? No one is intending to spread the virus. We know if you are sick, you will stay home.
And Birx warned this is no time to let our guard down.
Over the last 5 to 6 days, we've seen declines in cases across the country, and this has been very reassuring for us. At the same time, we know that mortality and the fatalities that we're facing across the United States continue.
In New York, where there are close to 11,000 people who have died from the coronavirus, Governor Andrew Cuomo continued a somber tone Wednesday, saying while the curve is flattening, there are still about 2,000 people a day coming down with the virus.
Lives lost yesterday, 752. Which is the painful news of our reality day after day, and they are in our thoughts and prayers.
He also said he plans to sign an executive order mandating some kind of facial protection.
You're not going to be able to maintain social distancing. You must wear a mask or cloth or an attractive bandana or a color-coordinated bandana.
The state of California is going to be giving cash payments to immigrants hurt by the coronavirus. AP correspondent Ed Donahue reports.
Governor Gavin Newsom says the money is a mix of taxpayer funds and gifts from philanthropists.
A total of $125 million.
These are people not eligible for federal relief.
10% of California's workforce is undocumented.
Newsom says the money will not be distributed based on income. Individuals would get up to $500, households up to $1,000.
For those individuals that are quite literally putting themselves on the line and helping support this economy and those most in need at this moment.
Newsom says California is a state that steps up to help people in need, regardless of status. I'm Ed Donahue.
Well, the World Health Organization says it's working with its partners to fill the financial gap left from the Trump administration's decision to withhold $400 million so that efforts to stop the coronavirus pandemic can continue without interruption. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to stop funding the World Health Organization comes just as the U.N. Health Agency says more than 2 million people globally are infected with the deadly coronavirus. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says he regrets Washington's decision, noting the U.S. has been a long-standing and generous friend to the WHO and hopes it will continue to be so. He says with support from the people and government of the United States, the WHO works to improve the health of many of the world's poorest and most vulnerable people.
WHO is not only fighting COVID-19. We're also working to address polio, measles, malaria, Ebola, HIV, tuberculosis, malnutrition, cancer, diabetes, mental health, and many other diseases and conditions.
Tedros says WHO is committed to providing health for all, regardless of race, religion, or political belief. Just as the organization does not discriminate among the peoples of the world, he says COVID-19 does not discriminate between rich and poor nations. It does not discriminate among nationalities, ethnicities, or ideologies.
This is a time for all of us to be united in our common struggle against a common threat, a dangerous enemy. When we're divided, the virus exploits the cracks between us. We're committed to serving the world's people and to accountability for the resources with which we're entrusted.
Trump accuses the organization of severely mismanaging its coronavirus response, of making deadly mistakes, and of being too trusting of China. The White House says funding will be halted while WHO's alleged cover-ups and failures are investigated, a process that could take 2 to 3 months. Tedros says WHO's performance in tackling the pandemic will be reviewed in due course by member states and independent bodies to ensure transparency and accountability. He says areas for improvement no doubt will be identified. He notes there will be lessons for everyone to learn. But for now, he says, the focus must be on stopping the virus and saving lives. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As countries around the world move toward ending lockdowns and restarting their economies, the European Union warned its 27 nations to move cautiously and base their plans around science to limit further spread of the coronavirus. In the U.S., President Donald Trump said Wednesday that he is enlisting advisors from nearly all sectors of American commerce, the medical field, and elected office to shape his plans to reopen the economy. And joining us now to talk more about the president's plans for reopening and the decision to defund the World Health Organization is Dr. Arthur Kaplan, professor of bioethics at New York University Langone Medical Center. Thanks so much for being with us. So the president's been very concerned about the economy, and rightly so, and has been looking to reopen business as soon as possible. We hear medical professionals, though, saying we are not prepared to do that yet. What's the reality here?
Everyone around the world wants to get back to work, get out of their isolation. It's very understandable that the question constantly pops up. And obviously, having the worldwide economy and the American economy shut down, suffering terrible job losses, that leads to trouble and problems, too. We have more domestic violence. We have people can't put food on the table. The suicide rate probably will go up. So it's a serious issue. But I don't think it's responsible to set dates. President Trump has said variously Easter, Memorial Day, other dates. I don't think that's correct because it gives the impression that everybody will come out on a given date. And that's not how things are going to work, at least not if we're going to try and balance tamping down the epidemic and saving lives against restoring the economy and getting some freedom to move around. The way it will work, I think, is governors will decide when their state's ready to come out. We could get a quick test and ramp up testing, which the president has not done. He talks about testing, but we don't have it. But if we get a saliva test, and it looks like a couple of those are happening where you don't even need to draw blood, you just spit in a cup and get a pretty quick result as to whether you're infected. Plus, we know that there's blood tests for people who have been infected but didn't die, survived it or had no symptoms, but probably built some immunity. Those are the people who can come out first. So I think what you'll see is a gradual, if you will, restoration of the economy, a gradual permission for people to come out either because they are immune, they've survived the virus, had the virus and it didn't kill them, or just large scale testing where we test every other day and make sure that you don't become positive and infect others.
By now, if we don't have nearly enough tests, it doesn't seem like we'll ever really know for sure when someone leaves their house what their status is, when they could be potentially one person spreading it to who knows how many. There are other states where the governors have never shut down the whole state. How concerned are you that we could likely see a second wave that could be bad?
I think we will see a second wave. You know, going all the way back to the 1918 flu epidemic that killed many people in the United States, it wasn't the first wave that was bad, it was the second. People came out, thing looked over, and then they came back, and that virus swept back with a vengeance. Mm-hmm. I think we'll see some of that. The good news, however, is we're learning how to treat people better if they have to go to the hospital. So we've learned a lot. We should be better prepared with protective gear and non-exhausted personnel and ventilators and so forth. At one end of the spectrum, and we'll do better if the thing reappears. On the other hand, there is going to be some sort of a calculation, and I'm going to say each state, not the federal government, but the states will do it and say, we're going to accept this many deaths to get the economy back. And that's a brutal, terrible, awful equation, but I think we're going to see it. I obviously lean toward trying to minimize the deaths. It doesn't do us much good if we're trying to go to work and we have to pass by endless numbers of cemeteries. It won't be good for morale, and people will be afraid, and many people won't go back to work or just won't come out. But I do think we're going to see that trade-off at some point. And it won't be in May. It'll be July, something like that. And then we'll see what happens with the return of the virus. I don't think we'll have a vaccine by then, but maybe we'll start to see some things come out that might be treatments, and that would be good too.
Right. I mean, I read an article this week that said social distancing will need to continue through 2022.
I think to really handle the epidemic, if we have no treatments and no vaccines, and all we've got is social distancing, you might get dates like 2022, but we're not going to make it that far. In the United States, people wouldn't stay shut in that long.
Right.
And at some point, the devastation to the economy overwhelms the damage from the epidemic. An interesting thing about coming out, I think you're going to have an app that's a passport that says, I am not positive. I am positive. I have immunoresistance. I have antibodies. I can't get sick and I won't make you sick. And if you're not willing to carry that app or paper passport, you're not coming out. So there'll be an interesting debate, particularly in the American context where freedom and civil liberties are very important values, about being willing to carry information that the government or your business or your employer can use to verify that it's okay to come out. I think that's another debate that will be part of this.
A lot of technicalities that would need to be put into place, and it just seems like things just aren't moving very fast. What do you think the implications are for the president's decision to freeze funding to the World Health Organization?
Well, some people have said that the president's decision is dangerous. The World Health Organization is the only organization that can watch this plague worldwide. Everything else is done by national governments or local states or provinces or regions. We have one group that can keep track of what's going on in Africa, in Asia, in countries that have either weak governments or weak healthcare systems or have refugee camps or displaced persons, and that's the World Health Organization. To defund it right now is like saying, there's a fire coming toward my house. I'm not happy with the drills that the fire department did. They seemed a little sloppy. So I think I'll fire them. You don't want to give up on your best protection in the middle of a plague. It's absurd. I think it's political, just trying to shift blame about who's responsible for the United States having so many deaths and being the world leader in infections and deaths. We didn't move fast enough. I don't think the president likes to admit that. He's been looking for a scapegoat. I think this week it's the WHO, but it's a very, very bad choice.
Do you think that that will cost lives?
I do think it'll cost lives. Plus, it increases the risk that the world will get a rebound, because you want to know, even if things are better in Europe, better in North America, if there's a big outbreak or a lot of people getting very, very sick in sub-Saharan Africa or in the Middle East or in Yemen or in refugee camps, then you know you've got to prepare for a rebound of the virus. And the only way to see that is WHO. Who else would be looking in those places?
Dr. Arthur Kaplan, professor of bioethics at New York University Langone Medical Center, thank you so much for being with us. Evidence of the coronavirus's devastating impact on the U.S. economy has been steadily emerging, and the signs have grown ominous. One marker came on Wednesday with unprecedented data that retail sales plummeted 8.7% in March. AP correspondent Rita Foley reports.
Sales plunged in a lot of categories: clothing, cars, restaurants, and bars. But grocery store sales jumped nearly 26% as Americans stocked up on food and consumer goods to ride out the pandemic. If overall sales are this bad for 1 month, what will the first half of the year look like? Fitch Ratings expects non-essential spending to collapse by as much as half. I'm Rita Foley.
Kenya's Ministry of Health will start mass testing of the population to contain the spread of the coronavirus. The first phase of the testing will prioritize high-density areas such as the slums of Nairobi and high-risk areas such as hospitals and quarantine centers. Raul Ambor reports from Nairobi.
29-year-old Lillian Chow contracted a mild cough less than 2 weeks after doctors confirmed Kenya's first COVID-19 case in Nairobi. She thought the cough would go away after a couple of days, but it persisted. It is only after Chow's close colleague died from the coronavirus that Chow suspected her cough might be something worse. She says, It was reported that one of our colleagues who died had COVID-19, and we had been in contact with her, together with a friend of mine, who we were experiencing the same symptoms. Doctors took us into quarantine. When my symptoms went down, I went back to work. We both did. The symptoms got stronger, and we were taken for testing. The results came back positive. Both Chow and her friend are now among dozens held in an isolation unit at Coast General Hospital in the city of Mombasa. Because of cases like those, Kenya's Ministry of Health announced Tuesday that it would start mass testing of the population to contain the spread of the virus. In Nairobi, Minister of Health Mutahi Kagwe said high-risk clusters would be given priority, including slum areas, hotels, hospitals, quarantine centers, and isolation facilities.
But who to test? You have got to move in a very targeted manner in order for that testing to be effective. For example, if you know that an institution has had one or two individuals who have tested positive, it makes sense to say, let's first of all round up this institution and test all those workers who have been working with that person.
The government said it had deployed 12,000 testing kits to areas that it had identified as high risk. Kenya's number of coronavirus cases has steadily risen over the past month. The virus has been found in at least 21 of 47 counties since the first case was reported on March 13th. In previous weeks, the World Health Organization warned that African countries were not getting accurate figures on the extent of coronavirus cases due to a lack of robust testing. Kenya's Ministry of Health has been testing an average of 400 samples per day, but on Tuesday, the country tested more than 800 samples in 24 hours, the highest figure so far. Kenya has confirmed 225 cases of the virus and recorded 10 deaths. Raya Lumbur for VOA News, Nairobi.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Efforts to slow the spread of the coronavirus may be putting a chokehold on already vulnerable food supplies in Africa. Lockdowns in at least 33 of Africa's 54 countries have blocked farmers from getting food to markets and threatened deliveries of food assistance to rural populations. Many informal markets where millions buy their food are now shut down. The U.S. military says Russia carried out a test of an anti-satellite missile Wednesday, calling it an example of the threats faced in space. The move comes as officials have said that space will increasingly become an important domain for warfare, with the U.S. and other countries stepping up their military postures in low Earth orbit and near the moon. Apple is releasing a new iPhone that will be vastly cheaper than the models it rolled out last fall when the economy was booming. The second generation iPhone SE will sell for as little as $399, a 40% markdown from the most affordable iPhone 11 that was unveiled last year when a pandemic had not forced people to rethink their spending. Stay with VOA for all the latest world news. 1 year after a tragic fire gutted Paris's iconic Notre Dame Cathedral, plans for a ceremony to mark the event were altered due to the pandemic. Still, the cathedral's great bell rang out Wednesday evening to celebrate resilience as residents opened their windows to thank medical workers battling the pandemic. International Edition's Steve Miller spoke to Paris-based reporter Nicolas Pinault about what's next for the beloved House of Worship.
French President Emmanuel Macron vowed to do his best to ensure the cathedral reconstruction will be finished by 2024. It's very ambitious, but he maintained that goal on a Twitter video this morning.
Yeah, you mentioned that this is an ambitious plan to rebuild the cathedral. You know, since the fire was extinguished, there have been efforts to begin that process. How far have they come along, and do you know what is being hindered by the current lockdown?
Right now, everything has paused. Repair work has halted mid-March, as you said. France imposed a lockdown. So right now there's no worker working on the site itself. Everything has been delayed probably until maybe the summer to make sure that they need to take additional security measures. Because the big problem right now is the lead poisoning on the site. That's something they've been very, very careful. And right now reconstruction efforts have not started yet, the real reconstruction. Because what they need to do right now, and this is very sensitive, they need to remove the scaffolding. Because basically when the fire happened, there was some restoration going on, and the scaffolding has not been moved since the fire, and part of the scaffolding has melted also in the fire. So it's very, very sensitive because it's a medieval structure, so you have to be very, very careful and very cautious. And right now, I guess by the summer, they will resume to start to take off the scaffolding.
Now, when you think about the Notre Dame Cathedral, it's one of many iconic locations around Paris. What does the restoration effort mean to Parisians and those in France in general during this time of a global pandemic?
Sure, and you have this iconic view of the two towers and the spire. So that's something people have been commenting a lot in France, because some people, they say we need to rebuild the exact same Notre Dame. Others says, you know, you have to adapt. It's going to be the 21st century. Of course, you don't have the same materials and you cannot build the exact same cathedral. Well, I think there is a consensus that maybe if it doesn't look the same, and because you have new materials, at least the new cathedral has to be more resistant to fire. So, of course, they're going to use new materials to be, make sure that this dramatic fire doesn't happen again. And I think also something very, very important is that right now you have a huge commission with architects. They're supposed to give an idea of their plan by the summer to reveal what it's going to look like, and especially the shape of the spire.
In his first interview since being released from prison, Australia's Cardinal George Pell has said his hardline conservative views on social issues were the reason he was prosecuted. Pell's convictions for child abuse were unanimously quashed by Australia's High Court earlier this month. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Cardinal George Pell was the world's most senior Catholic official to be jailed for child abuse. He served more than a year of a six-year prison sentence after being found guilty of sexually assaulting two choir boys in a cathedral in the city of Melbourne in the 1990s. He'd always protested his innocence, and this month was acquitted by Australia's High Court. It found there was a reasonable doubt that Pell had the time or the opportunity to commit the alleged crimes after a busy Sunday Mass almost 25 years ago. In an interview with Australia's Sky News, Cardinal Pell has spoken publicly for the first time since his release from prison. He described the complainant who testified against him as a poor fellow and said the man may have been manipulated by Pell's critics. The former Vatican treasurer said he was a casualty of a so-called culture war with opponents who disliked his conservative views on same-sex marriage and abortion. Pell also took aim at the justice system in the state of Victoria, where he was convicted after a trial in December 2018. Cardinal Pell said it weighed too heavily in favour of alleged victims of abuse.
We need good policemen. We need good judges, good prosecutors. It's not a sign of a civilization where you have guilt by accusation. The pendulum 30, 40 years ago is massively against anybody who said that they'd been attacked. Nowadays, we don't want it to swing back so that every accusation is regarded as gospel truth.
It's now being reported that Cardinal Pell faces fresh allegations from a new accuser. Pell has told Australian TV he wouldn't be entirely surprised if police came after him again. Asked at a media conference if the force had a vendetta against the former Archbishop of Melbourne and Sydney, Victoria's Deputy Police Commissioner Shane Patton said he had no comment to make in respect to Cardinal Pell. Police in Sydney have investigated threats made on social media against the 78-year-old Cardinal Pell since his release. The former papal advisor spent more than 400 days in jail before being freed on April 7. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. As parents feel the stress of juggling work from home and homeschooling their children during the COVID-19 pandemic, grandparents are pitching in to help. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has details on how one grandfather is teaching his grandchildren.
Learn a bit about how they work.
Television editor Jason Smith has two daughters, 8 and 4 years old. Like many parents, he has been working from home.
Put the lid on top, they'd fill it with
and trying to teach his children during the pandemic.
It would be totally sick.
I am running homeschool like a lot of people who don't have any experience in this whatsoever. My wife is a teacher, but she's busy teaching all day. And so I am teaching the kids.
David Smith, an academic and Jason's dad, wanted to do something to help, and that's how grandparent school began. Using video conferencing, the first day is a history lesson. He used a map, slides, and this model he built. This battle at the start of the American Revolution shows the fight at the Old North Bridge in Concord between the British and the colonials in Massachusetts.
And then I like to end up with something real, like the diorama, where I can actually point to things that I think may have looked like.
No cars, no trucks.
He tries to describe it in a way that is fun and relevant to his granddaughters.
This happened in a far, far away and a long time ago. Something they're familiar with because the girls have watched Star Wars, at least the first or second, whatever, they've watched some of them. So they know that concept. And so we had the evil empire and the rebels.
They were rude.
You know, they're 4 years old and 8 years old. Both of them had a lot of questions. They had a lot of comments, which kind of surprised me. But it was fun. I think they may have learned something.
Smith is already preparing for his next 20-minute lesson on riverboats, using the model he made during the pandemic as a teaching tool. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Beyond the horizon of the place we lived when we were young, in a world of magnets and miracles.
Two veteran rock bands will try to help fill the void of music for fans who've been missing going to live concerts in the age of COVID-19 lockdown. Starting Friday, classic rock band Pink Floyd will release 5 concert films every week for 4 weeks on YouTube. The first is Pulse, which was recorded in 1994. Beginning Saturday, band Genesis will release the first of a series of concert films. The first is Three Sides Live, which features parts of 2 live shows from back in 1981.
Leaving the myriad small creatures trying to tie us to the ground, to a life consumed by slow decay. The grass was greener.
Listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Mwangane, I'm Lori London in Washington. Please take care and stay well.
Looking beyond the embers of bridges glowing behind us, to a glimpse of how good it was on the other side. Stay. walking back again, dragged by the force of some inner tide.
This is VOA News.